Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The New Statesman.
The British royal family was in crisis even before Queen Elizabeth II died, and the new king and the Princess of Wales both became ill with cancer. In this modern age, where access increasingly equates to relevance and truth and conspiracy so often intertwine, how is Britain's relationship with monarchy changing? I'm Chris Stone, and this is the New Statesman podcast. To discuss all of this and more, I was joined by journalist Tanya Gold, whose essay The Fragile Crown is the cover feature of this week's New Statesman magazine. In it, she addresses the successive crises that have beset the royal family and what the public response tells us about our relationship with the monarchy and Britain's national story. One of the main themes that runs throughout Tanya's piece is this idea that the contortions that we, the public, require of the royal family no longer work. And this, she argues, has been made obvious by the response to the Princess of Wales' illness. So, firstly, what does she see as the contortions that we require of the royals?
Monarchy is an ancient system, right? And the world has had monarchies for far longer than it's had liberal democracies. And you could say, in a way, we are more used to them. You know, they seep into our subconscious. One of the things people used to say about the late Elizabeth II is that almost everyone in the country at some point or another would have dreamt about her. So already we've got these sort of dream figures rooted in history and legend and myth. But we have such a different world now. And the fact that the British monarchy, which is the second oldest monarchy in the world after Japan, has hung on is far more a curio than anything else. It sort of survived by accident. We all know that after the First World War, the crowns of Europe toppled like ninepins. They all left, but are survived. So we have this ancient system at the top. But of course, around that and under it, the world has changed. We are far more secular. We have a dogma of equality and fairness, though we do not always follow it through. These are accepted beliefs. And yet at the top, we have the preeminent example of inherited wealth and power in the entire world. And two different groups are trying to negotiate this. One is the people, the subjects, and one is the monarchy at the top. And I think in that contradiction and in those strivings, we're seeing everything that has come to a head in recent months.
Tanya mentioned that Britain's monarchy is the second oldest in the world after Japan's, and maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it's not, that this week, Japan's imperial family finally joined Instagram. As social media analyst Andrew Hughes put it, they were perhaps the last notable royal family not to fully engage the digital era. This decision from the Japanese royal household hints at this increased need, globally, for the public to have increased access to their leading figures. But back to the UK and our own royal family's press management. In the past few months, both the King and the Princess of Wales became ill with cancer. Charles's illness was briefed quite simply. The palace issued a statement that cancer had been discovered as part of the treatment for an enlarged prostate. But Catherine's wasn't so straightforward. It was announced that she was having planned abdominal surgery and would be absent from public life until Easter, but then Prince William pulled out of an event at the last minute. Her public appearance at Trooping the Colour in June was announced and then retracted, and conspiracy theories started to spring up, especially on social media. The marriage was over. She was dead. And the palace didn't help matters by issuing a manipulated photo, which was then pulled by photo agencies. Then, finally, after social media rumours had grown so large, traditional media was beginning to comment on them, Catherine herself appeared in a video announcing that she had cancer and was receiving preventative chemotherapy. What were Tanya's observations of both the handling of this and what the public's response highlighted about our relationship with the monarchy?
I don't think that the King and the Princess of Wales being sick are by themselves a crisis. You know, people get sick all the time. They need to be allowed to be sick. But I do think that the reports and the way that it was handled and the way that people responded is exposing a crisis for monarchy and with it a crisis for the country. I think far more significant than these announcements of illness, than these facts of illness, are two other things that we're talking about a little bit less at the moment. The first was the exposure, or rather the involvement of the King's brother, the Duke of York, in a sex scandal in New York, after which he had to lose his HRH title and is basically exiled from public life. So we have this instance of corruption and unfitness right at the top. And the other one, of course, is the self-exile of Prince Harry, who we all know, he wrote a whistleblowing book called Spare. I read it as a whistleblowing book. Other people see it as sour grapes. And his story of the cruelty and the frigidity inside monarchy, of how impossible it is, and of course Harry's had a front seat all his life, how impossible it is for him to live inside the system, of how cruel and dehumanizing and, in the end, for his mother, deadly. So I think it was a system that was already in crisis. And then with these announcements of the sickness and the crazy response to it, it became exposed.
And the conspiracy theories?
Well, of course, the conspiracy theories were not universal. Not everyone was going on Twitter and saying really cruel and agonizing things about people who, I have to remind seemingly everybody, are real people. It was the collusion in it. And that was even that sort of decent, normal, sane people who aren't always on Twitter and aren't writing that the princess is anorexic or has had a nose job or her husband has betrayed her or is dead, were treating it with a really obscene kind of levity. And that did seem to be rather universal. And I look back and I think this is exactly what happened to Princess Diana, but it's worse. We are no longer treating these people as human beings with rights.
Tanya told me that what she found the most awful about Catherine's announcement that she had been diagnosed with cancer was that she started by thanking everyone.
I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you personally for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I've been recovering from surgery.
This was obscene, says Tanya, after Catherine had been the focus of a global maelstrom of bullying and dehumanisation, that she had to sit there and thank the public.
We expect them to be immaculate and perfect and never say anything and never do anything. And that was the model that developed under Elizabeth II. They're supposed to sit there and stay the same and smile and be brilliantly and immaculately British so we can get on and do whatever we're doing, which usually, in my analysis, seems to be being really quite infantile and throwing away liberal democracy with both hands. So we have this expectation of them. But on the other hand, then we have a second desire, which is to tear them to pieces. We are so much more interested in them when they make mistakes, when they're unhappy, when they screw up. So there's a contradiction there. And I think that is the contradiction that is deadly and vicious. And I just wonder how much longer this can go on, because I think we're going to look back on Elizabeth II as a kind of anomaly. It was Churchill who said that if you were going to cast somebody to be queen, you couldn't think of anyone better. For whatever reason, and I'll tell you my theories if you want, she was absolutely perfect at it. And she was born into the right age as well. She didn't have to struggle with social media. She was already into her 80s when that happened. She had a supportive partner and a stable marriage. You know, she was sane. For some reason, it bounced off her. That whatever madness emerged, it bounced off her. But I really don't think that the new generation are like that. And I am a Republican. I don't think it's an adult way to run your country. There's an argument for monarchy that it fills the space. It stops anything else more toxic filling the space. It protects us from Trump. It protects us from Caesar. But the problem with that is human nature, that old caveat. And I really think that what we're expecting of them is impossible.
In her essay, Tanya repeats, "The system never fails, only the people." She goes on to provide a list of individuals who have been chewed up and spat out by the royal machine or notarized in crises of their own making. Does this gilded cage allow anyone in this family to be happy?
I went to Balmoral 2 days after Elizabeth II died, and there was this bizarre carnival of people laying flowers, people weeping. The press were allowed to approach the mourners, but you had to do it with a great deal of sensitivity. And if you had expressed a Republican thought, I suspect you would have been chased out of town. And then the royal family came out, all the Queen's, the late Queen's children, except the King. And they stood there. We were put behind a rope and we just stared at them while they came and looked at the flowers. And I mean, of course, they were grieving, but I couldn't escape the thought, this is torture. We are torturing them with our attention. The King, who was in his mid-70s when he ascended to the throne, didn't have time to process his grief like you and I or any other person would be allowed to do. He immediately had to embark on a tour of Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland to show his fitness in this strange relic of feudalism. I mean, we do have some stuff on the record, of course. Prince Harry, obviously an incredibly unhappy man, who's talked about how he has PTSD from being royal. He talked about how when he was a child and his mother would be driving them around London, I believe this was after she lost her HRH protection. She lost her HRH and she lost her royal protection. And the reason she lost her royal protection is because she no longer trusted the royal family because of the Martin Bashir episode, when he sent her all this false information that meant that she no longer trusted anyone within the royal machine. And Prince William said later that it caused her a great deal of grief and heartbreak in her later years. So she had lost her protection and she would drive around London and paparazzi would follow her and they would call her a whore in front of her children to try and get the reaction shot of her shouting or her screaming or her losing her cool. It's the duality again, you know, the immaculate princess and then the raging human being.
And this unhappiness due to a life of restraint and restriction is not a modern phenomenon. We've seen it play out again and again throughout the last century.
The late Queen's sister, Princess Margaret, was not allowed to marry the man that she loved, Group Captain Peter Townsend, without losing her royal title. And the late Elizabeth II once said, and I believe she said this of Harry and Meghan, you can't be half in and half out, you know, and how true that is. Princess Margaret was not bred to live outside the royal family. She wasn't raised not to have a title, to be a housewife in Belgium with Group Captain Peter Townsend, to be Mrs. Townsend. And she had enough self-awareness to know that. So they didn't marry, very famously, and she married somebody else on the rebound, somebody who was involved with somebody else. The marriage was a complete bin fire. And she coped as best she could. And to go back one further generation before I stop, of course, we had Edward VIII, who never wanted to marry a royal princess, never wanted to marry an aristocratic English woman. He wanted to marry a twice divorced American woman. And that, of course, wasn't allowed. He said that he couldn't reign without her. He couldn't reign alone. And so he gave up the crown and spent the rest of his life being traduced for it. I don't think that being a member of the royal family is conducive to emotional health and to happiness. And I think it's interesting, and I mean, I can only speak from what I've observed, you know, we can't crawl inside their souls much as we would like to. The ones who do seem most functional and happy are the ones who haven't been given royal titles due to the intervention of their parents.
But while royal misery has not just sprung up in recent years, there is something that's changed, and that's how we, the public, participate in the game. Tanya writes, monarchs are supposed to be mortal gods, though increasingly we treat them as toys. And then we see our princesses as Cindy dolls with infinite uses, futures, and woes. What is it that's shifted in the public consciousness, morphing the monarchy from gods to playthings?
I certainly think that until the mid-20th century, monarchy was a very well-established system in this country. It was very popular. And there was a huge amount of respect. The press was very respectful. They treated them with kid gloves. They treated them as they wished to be treated. And I think when we go back and look over it, I think if you are going to have a constitutional monarchy, a respectful distance is going to be the only thing that works. And you had that until then. The Queen barely got any bad press till the 70s, in the famous year. And then there was a famous documentary about them and it got in way too close. And there was a bad reaction from the public and then they stopped doing it. So they were treated very well by the newspapers. I mean, the most famous example, of course, is when George V died. Again, going quite a way back, but I would say the Windsors have soaring archives and very long memories. You know, they've been in charge for 1,000 years, so 100 years is nothing. And when he died, they didn't want the death to be reported in the less respectful evening papers. They wanted it in the Times. So in the evening, his doctor basically euthanized him to make the announcement in the Times, which is where they wanted it to be. So they were protected.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ten years ago, Hilary Mantel, the late historical fiction writer, perhaps best known for her 2009 novel Wolf Hall, published an essay in the London Review of Books titled Royal Bodies. She notes the day she believes the public consciousness shifted. A new world began, I think, she writes, in 1980, with the discovery that Diana, the future Princess of Wales, had legs. You will remember how the young Diana taught for a few hours a week at a kindergarten called Young England, and when it was first known that she was Charles's choice of bride, the press photographed her, infants touchingly gathered round. But they induced her to stand against the light, so in the resulting photograph, the nation could see straight through her skirt. A sort of licentiousness took hold, a national lip-smacking. Those gangling limbs were artlessly exposed without her permission. It was the first violation.
And Diana was something completely different. The treatment of her was completely different. And she was completely different. She exposed, I think, and she was the first person to expose, absolutely, how toxic this system is if you are not temperamentally suited for it, as the late Queen was. And Diana was the first royal media superstar. She eclipsed her husband. That was part of the reason I understand that their marriage fell apart. Envy and jealousy. They know that this system is unstable. They know that our affection is whimsical. And they brief against each other. And they compete to be top of the rankings. But Diana was bewitching. She was bewitching because she was brave and she was interesting. And she couldn't hide her feelings. And we know what happened. What began within, I'm sure, Arthur Edwards of the Sun thought was an innocent and feel-good picture of a woman's legs ended with photographers taking pictures of a woman who was dying in a tunnel in Paris, and then questions at the later inquest about whether she was pregnant or not, literally wanting to peer inside her body. We cannot treat them with any compassion. And it's always the women who get it worst. Look, even Catherine Middleton, you know, who seems to be an impeccable person, who always did her best. Weighty Katie, they called her, because William was so anxious about putting somebody else through what his mother went through, that it took him a long time to make up his mind that they would get married, and possibly a long time for her as well. And then all the snobbery around her mother. And then Meghan, of course. Meghan was bullied by the British media. And I think what was interesting about the response to Meghan is there was something for everyone. You know, in one part of the newspaper, there'd be a Meghan is great. And in the next part of the newspaper, there would be a Meghan sucks. And this isn't normal behaviour. I don't blame her at all. I mean, of course you can say, you know, don't read it. But she was torn apart in the British media. And that's just not an acceptable way to behave. And I don't blame her that she found it untenable. I mean, my own theory about Meghan is the same as my theory about Edward VIII and Wallis Simpson, which is they wanted to get out. So they married people who would be their life rafts. You know, Meghan is too American and too Californian. She had her own life before this. She was never going to put up with this for long. And I know that they behave very, very strangely, and the announcement of the birth was sort of botched and weird. But what you're dealing with here, in my opinion, is two incredibly angry people who just don't want to put up with it anymore. And I saw them when she was heavily pregnant. I saw them at the Natural History Museum. They were going to an event. And they've gawped at, and there were hundreds of flashbulbs. I mean, things have changed since the 1970s, when there'd be one reporter on the Royal Rota and a curtsy. And I don't really believe in that either. But I think we have to accept that I think this is getting quite close to a sickness. You know, when the behaviour of the media, which of course is all fueled by people's desire to read about it, you can't just blame the newspapers. They wouldn't do it if it didn't sell.
As Tanya says, they wouldn't do it if it didn't sell. One of the things that struck me watching the treatment of Catherine, and as Tanya described, of Meghan, is that it's women specifically that people, royalists especially, claim to love. And maybe in that love they feel a sense of ownership, and perhaps confuse privacy with secrecy. What does this say about the British public?
I think it's very interesting that you use the word love, because I don't think it's love at all, though people, I think they say it's love so they can live with themselves. What it really is a massive act of projection, which goes back to what monarchs were originally supposed to be, which is sort of scapegoat and God at the same time. They would protect us, but they would also be our sin eaters. You know, they had a very important symbolic role at the heart of society. And I think that this is a superannuated postmodern version of this. People project onto them. I can be so beautiful. I can have this life, this glorious gilded life. I can be the princess in the castle. And yet I can't do it, so she's going to do it for me. But then we've also begun to project our more destructive and darker tendencies onto them as well. I mean, it's a very bizarre thing to watch, this combination of adoration on the one hand and a desire to destroy we literally want to turn them inside out now. The Prince of Wales had to tell us what was inside her, you know, cancer. So I think we're treating them as these bizarre totems. And I think the reason we do that is because I think it's kind of fun. And it stops us having to look at our own lives. It's always been like this.
It's a truism of addiction, and many are addicted to monarchy, Tanya writes, that the larger your fantasy life, the smaller your real one.
Well, I know it's an addiction because I watch The Last Night of the Proms sometimes, and I see when Land of Hope and Glory comes on and everyone goes crazy. The late imperial anthem, you know, a fifth of the globe, a gorgeous royal family, it all belongs to us. And you can listen to that, even as a secular Jew, a secular Republican Jew, you can listen to that and you can feel the drug in it. It allows us, this ideal of monarchy allows us to believe that our country is more important and more exceptional and more gilded than it really is, that we're better than other people, basically. And I think Elizabeth II, who presided over managed decline, I mean, all historians say that, it was perfectly obvious, you know, it was an age of decline. She managed, you know, with her skill, to sort of help us look away from that, to help us not realise that. But now she's gone. We're left with the reality, because her successors have an impossible job to do, which is to project an ideal of family and an ideal of country, which patently don't exist, while at the same time we're trying to tear them apart and look inside them. My own wish is that, I mean, I think they should abdicate, but what will probably happen, I suspect, is it will continue to go on. We seem to have become a nation of people who just allow ourselves to drift. It will go on until something so shocking happens, you know, either something we do to them or they do to themselves, that it just all falls apart. I mean, Elizabeth II's ratings were very, very solid, and remain so. We still poll on her. Support for the monarchy among young people is dropping like a stone. And I think even towards the end of Elizabeth II's reign, it was an inch deep and a mile wide, and could melt away tomorrow.
You can read Tanya's essay in the latest issue of the New Statesman magazine, which is available on newsstands now, or read it on the New Statesman website. The link is in the show notes. We publish new episodes 3 times a week. Hit the follow button on your podcast app to make sure you get new content as soon as it's released. And if you enjoyed this, please leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts or rate the show on Spotify. You can also watch video from this podcast on the New Statesman's YouTube channel. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Chris Stone, and my guest, Tanya Gold. Anoush and the team will be back on Thursday to discuss the week in politics. This episode was produced by me and edited by Catherine Hughes.
Trust in politics is broken, so can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.